Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Creative Control is brought to you by Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, CFRU 93.3 FM, and Granddad's Donuts, and features an interview with Dr. Susan Rogers, a prolific music engineer and producer who famously worked with Prince and is currently the director of the Berkeley Music Perception and Cognition Laboratory. This conversation was recorded before a live audience at the Megafono Festival in Ottawa, Ontario, on Friday, February 8th, 2019.
Thank you very much, everyone. Welcome to this church. And I'd like to, without further ado, introduce our guest of honor today, Susan Rogers.
Thank you.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you for coming out and thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk about music and music science and all sorts of things related to the stuff we all, I assume everyone in this room loves.
Yes, yes, it's very exciting. I thought today we would get to know more about you and your role in some of the work you just described. And first of all, I wanted to say welcome to Ottawa. Have you ever been to Ottawa before?
Never Ottawa, no.
Never. Do you have any perspectives on Ottawa? Have you ever thought about Ottawa?
It's close to Toronto. Kind of. Oh, that's bad? Okay.
Well, it's far.
Very different from Toronto, as far as I can tell.
That's right.
Well, I love Canada. Some of the happiest years of my life were spent in grad school in Montreal for
that's
4 years.
And right.
Certainly the greatest commercial success I've experienced were with the ladies, Bare Naked Ladies, as well as Odds out in Vancouver.
Oh.
So the times that I've spent here, either studying or making records, are among my most cherished memories. So it always feels good to come to Canada.
Right, so you did attend school in Montreal, but never, that's fascinating that you never made the trek here, because, and I'm not, this is not meant to disparage you in any way, but that's fascinating. You were so close.
They kept us really busy.
That's right.
Really busy in grad school.
They do that, that's true. So where are you currently based? Where are you living?
I'm in Boston.
You're in Boston.
After I left McGill, I was hired by a former friend of mine, was the dean in the Department of Music Technology there, or the Division of Music Technology, and he persuaded me to come to Berkeley. It wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted in my fantasy mind, I thought that I was going to become a researcher, and initially I wanted to work with pigs.
Well, who doesn't?
Yeah. I had worked with musicians my whole adult life, and I wanted to be, in my fantasy life, a cognitive ethologist. And in particular, I chose pigs to be the subject of my study. It's the only intelligent animal that we eat. All the rest of them we leave alone, but mm-hmm. we're not treating the pig very well. And I wanted to, just for the fun of it, that's why scientists do what they do. But my friend explained to me, he said, your science career is going to be really, really short. I got my PhD at age 52. It doesn't make sense and do a postdoc and compete with the 26-year-olds. Hmm. And he said, you know, I can give you a grown-up salary if you come here. Mm-hmm. And you can teach your virtual PhD, which is record production and engineering, as well as your actual PhD, which is music cognition and psychoacoustics. And I kind of crunched the numbers mentally and said, yeah, that makes sense. I'll do that.
Well, you mentioned that you'd spent so much time working with adult males. In the music industry, do you see a parallel between adult male musicians and pigs? Is there a through line there? I think there is, personally.
There could be. I don't know pigs very well. I don't know pig nature. I've never had a pig. I'd like to someday. But I understand they're intelligent and they're affectionate, and certainly the men I've worked with have been all that.
Yes, okay. Good. You said pig a lot there, by the way. That was a lot of iterations of pig. So you're in Boston now. Where did you grow up, per se?
Southern California, Anaheim, California.
Anaheim, California. And when did you develop? Was your family life good? Was your family supportive of your interests, so to speak?
Oh, no. Well, yeah. Kind of. I'm the oldest of four. I have three younger brothers.
I see.
And unfortunately, very good parents, very good, but lower middle class, working class. But my mother got very ill when I was 8, and she passed away when I was 14.
Right.
So after that, it was kind of every man for himself. My father, and this actually I've come to find out, was a very good thing. He set the bar very low for my brothers and me. Get a job. And you're good. Get a job. And you're golden. And his dream for me was I'd go to work for a grocery store because I'd be in a union.
Oh, I see. Your father had three jobs, didn't he?
Well, he had quite a lot.
Quite
he worked
jobs,
morning, noon, and night.
Yeah.
But I wanted something more for myself. I'll jump over and just kind of do a leapfrog over some of the major points. But I got married when I was 17 in order to just be an adult and start my own life. And fortunately for me, I married someone who was very abusive, physically abusive. He used to beat the crap out of me. He was jealous. So it sounds like this story is going to be sad, but it's not.
You did say fortunately.
Yes. Which, yeah. Because he was bad, I could leave him guilt-free. If I had married a good man at age 17, I would have stayed with him. Mm. I mean, you know, you'd want to. But he was bad. And because he was bad, I could flee and feel no guilt about that. So I finally, at age 21, is when I responded to that inner call that had been there since I was this big to be where records were being made. And I moved to Hollywood, which wasn't that far away, and I got started.
So how did you actually get started? Let's get into that. Actually, before that, what sparked your initial interest in music as a teenager? If I recall correctly, you were around 7 years old when the Beatles were kind of on the rise, right? But if I understand things correctly, you didn't really care for them. The Beatles were kind of omnipresent. I grew up a Beatles fan as well, and I've always thought they were kind of cool. But in retrospect, I imagine when something is so omnipresent, they're not as cool. It's like U2 or Coldplay in our modern parlance. They're just sort of everywhere, and then they don't have the cachet.
Yeah.
Growing up with the Beatles at the time, were they kind of considered a bit lame in any way, or were they always kind of cool?
Well, I was pretty little. I didn't really know what cool was, but all the kids were talking about them, and there were older teenage girls on the block
right.
who that's all they could talk about. No, it's an interesting thing, and I'd love to see this explored scientifically. I believe that children know their resonant frequency. I believe that children know what they like and what they dislike. And as long as adults aren't telling them who they are or what they should like or dislike, if you let them decide for themselves, they'll tell you, I think pretty honestly, what they like and what they don't. And I recognize that the Beatles were okay, but there was other stuff that I heard on the radio that I was more responsive to.
This was when you were seven, roughly? 7 years old?
Seven, eight, nine, ten, okay. Right in that age. And as it turns out, in speaking as a brain scientist now, the age between the ages of 8 and 11 is when the human brain makes some important changes in order to get ready for puberty. And humans are as musical as they're ever going to be by the age of 11, unless they take music lessons, which will keep the clay wet. Mm. But anyway, right around that age, I was recognizing when James Brown would come on the radio, when Sly and the Family Stone would come on, you'd be a little kid and you'd be going, yeah. Now that just feels right. And who knows where that comes from, but so it's an inner knowing of, yeah, that just seems right to me.
Given your cognitive knowledge now and the studies that you have engaged in, are you saying you don't know why James Brown and Sly and the Family Stone would have resonated to you at that point?
I don't think we know. I'm going to talk a little bit about it tomorrow, the mechanisms through which people bond to music, but... we know that we can bond to music through the motor pathway. It makes us move a certain way, or music makes us think a certain way. The lyrics usually do that, or the chord changes in melody can make us feel a certain way. And some of us have a greater appetite for rhythm, or a greater appetite for lyrics, or for melody. The Beatles fans were hankering for melody, whereas some of us wanted to wait the mixture a little bit more strongly on the rhythm. The rhythm mattered more. And unless it had that deep pocket, it wasn't giving the same level of satisfaction.
Is that a visceral thing? Is there a distinction to be made between intellectually processing melody and rhythm more or less making you move?
Yeah, there are all these brain circuits is what I was about to say, and that sounds really stupid.
Stupid to me. I'm kind of dumb. That sounded smart.
It's the understatement of the year. There are 100 billion neurons in the brain,
right.
And so these paths are all interconnected. But a shorthand version is human beings, unlike certain other primates and monkeys, have a lot of connectivity between the auditory cortex right here and the motor cortex. So music makes us move. And movement makes us want to move in a steady rhythm. So the two things, movement and music, go together perfectly. But then there are also these frontal lobe connections that are constantly judging things. And people like that. Animals like that. They like to judge. So when you listen to a piece of music that you think is really clever or especially beautiful, you'll bond to that.
Yes.
And you'll judge it as being your music. The best music, and you'll tell everyone else this is the best, and you're going to stick to your guns unless that band comes out with a really bad album.
Right. So you hear Sly and the Family Stone, you hear James Brown, this sparks an interest in music when you're young, and you mentioned that as you got older you moved to Hollywood to explore record making, but between that time when you hear these songs and these artists, and that time where you move and try to do something about it, what was your engagement with music like beyond being a fan? Did you try to play music? Were you interested in that in any way? Like, I'm going to try to learn how to play instruments.
No. My mother insisted that we buy a piano because she saw how interested I was in music, and they got me piano lessons, and it brought me no joy whatsoever, and it brought the listeners any joy whatsoever. It really didn't even feel musical to me. Going through those exercises did not give me the satisfaction that listening to the radio and listening to records did. Another thing that has not been studied, but I really think there's an aspect of musicianship that involves listening. I believe that my musicality, such as it is that I am a really good listener.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Chris DeRitas is here, and Chris is another one, I'm sure, cut from that same cloth. What we do is we listen to music.
Okay. Did you have any other creative outlets beyond music
growing up as a child or a teenager? Did you do anything in the realm of creative or cultural production?
Not especially. You know, like a lot of kids, I like to draw and I like to read. Brain science also shows us that there are different archetypes of thinkers. Mm. The type of thinker I am is an engineering type. I gravitated to neuroscience and to engineering because I'm better at building things than inventing things.
I see.
Which is why I was a good match for the artists I worked with Prince or with Gagita or with Bare Naked Ladies. People who think of, artists who think of new ideas need builders to help them facilitate those ideas. And that's what I was strong at.
You felt that you were more mechanically inclined on some
level? Definitely. And more practical and logic based.
Right.
I don't invent things de novo from the new, but if someone comes to me with a good idea, I can help them build it.
So prior to moving to Hollywood, had you developed some kind of base foundation of skills to become an engineer, or did you move to Hollywood with the impulse to try to develop those skills?
Yeah, I knew absolutely nothing. I couldn't have told you one side of a battery from another.
Okay.
When I started. I knew absolutely nothing. I just had this desire to be in the music business where records were being made, and I did have good self-awareness of what I was capable of doing. I knew that I liked to study, and I knew that anything technical would probably be a good fit for me.
Hmm.
I talk with students about this a little bit. There's a difference between our strengths and our motives. And not all of us, in fact, most of us don't have perfect overlap between what we're good at and what we want to do.
Right.
It would really behoove young people to find the Venn diagram, that overlap between what you're good at and what you really want. And I happen to find that. I'm good at being technical, and that's what I wanted to be in the music business. I did not want to be on the other side of the glass writing or performing music. I had no interest in that.
Right. Okay. So you moved to one of the particularly intriguing aspects of your story, as far as I understand it, is that you were very much a self-starter in terms of your craft. You are one of the earliest proponents, I think, of DIY in music, doing things yourself. Am I correct? Did you kind of self-teach yourself everything that you know?
Just by reading the books. I wanted to be a technician, and my roommate got me a job as a receptionist in a tiny little one-room schoolhouse for auditory arts. And as I was working behind the desk one day, I overheard one of the teachers say to a student, "Become a maintenance tech. You'll always have a job in the music business." And I thought, okay, well, then that's what I'll do. I'll become a maintenance tech. And the maintenance tech is different from the audio engineer. The technician is the one who repairs the equipment. And I was so willing to do that if it would allow me to be where records were being made. So I studied basic electronics, theories of electronics, and audio technology, of course. I read Modern Recording Techniques, the first edition, wore the spine out of that book. And
yeah.
I studied acoustics and the principles of magnetism and all those sorts of things so that I could be part of the conversation.
It's fascinating to me because I've interviewed some younger artists who are in the realm of hip-hop production or electronic music production. I'm thinking of an artist from Brampton who goes by Wonder Girl, who ended up having a beat on a Jay-Z album, the weakest Jay-Z album, but still. And then also Harrison, an electronic artist from Toronto. In both those cases, when I asked them, how did you learn how to do what you do? They said, YouTube. I learned how to play all the musical instruments, and all the technical aspects of what I know are just from YouTube videos. So that's kind of, to me, that seemed like a newer phenomenon. And then I read your story, and this is definitely pre-YouTube, right? You didn't have YouTube when you were learning how to...
We had cathode ray tubes.
It's an early version of YouTube. No, you simply, where did you get these books from? Like, now it's so easy. We Google things we don't know. I took apart a washing machine. Me. I don't know how to do anything. It was fun. I enjoyed
great?
It. I took it out of the thing and I took it apart from some guy made a YouTube video.
Isn't
and I fixed
great?
My wife. It's really satisfying and fulfilling. But at the same time, I've tried to, you know, take, in the past I was put in guitar lessons, or I've put my son in piano lessons, you know, and he's kind of like you. There's a bit of a, he likes it, but there's also a little joylessness in it. But anyway, this is a really interesting time because a lot of musicians have access to information to teach them how to improve themselves. They also have access to distribution channels for their music because of the internet. So all I'm saying really is I feel like when I hear your story, it seems like a pioneering aspect of what's going on a lot now of just like, I want to learn how to do this. I'm going to teach myself. No one's going to help me. And I'm just curious about that impulse to be like, you were just driven to do it.
Yeah, you do have to have, you have to have that full can of whoop ass. you're going to need it because you're going to expend a lot of it climbing up that hill. There's a book that just came out last October by some Harvard researchers. It's called Dark Horse, and I was featured in it along with several others in different fields. The thesis of this book is most people pursue success in order to be fulfilled, but some of us pursue fulfillment in order to be successful.
Yes.
And I always just did what made me happy and right. still do. I pursued personal fulfillment. This is what I'm curious about. This is what I want.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough that success came as a byproduct of that. And I think thanks to the availability of information, more people now will be able yeah. to do that. They'll, as long as they're in touch with what it is they want. And as I said earlier, the degree to which that overlaps with their skills, they should be able to find others who have walked that same path in front of them, mm-hmm. and they can follow in those footsteps, or at least take someone else's map. In my case, after the bad husband, I had a very good boyfriend, and he was also an electronics genius. His electronics textbook came from the U.S. Army, and he suggested I get mine there, too.
Oh, interesting.
So I called the U.S. Army, the local recruiter. I just called the recruiting station, and I lied about my age. I said, I'm 16 years old, and I'm going to get out of high school, and I'm going to join the Army, so I want to study electronics. Will you send me your electronics manuals? And they did. They sent me the full volume, just for the cost of postage, DC principles up to microwave technology. I still have those books.
You lied to the Army?
I lied to the Army.
It's an aspect yeah. of your story I hadn't heard before.
Yeah, it was totally worth it.
So let's talk about how you went from gathering books and data to having practical experience with the equipment you were likely mm-hmm. reading about. How did that occur, and
yeah,
where did that occur?
I was looking for work, and the Los Angeles Times newspaper, we were just talking about how we feel bad about journalism and the absence of newspapers and media.
Oh, backstage, that's true,
yeah,
we were. Yeah.
It's rough. But back when there were newspapers that had want ads in the back, the back of the LA Times said audio trainee wanted, and it was for a company called Audio Industries, right on La Brea, across from A&M Studios in Hollywood, and I just happened to live up the street from them, and they interviewed me, and they hired me. So the tech crew there taught me to be one of the tech crew, and what we did was we sold and serviced MCI consoles and tape machines. I didn't sell them, but I repaired them in the greater Los Angeles area. Mm. It was the best education I could have hoped for because I'm working in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
The year I started was 1978, repairing consoles and tape machines, and I'm going to studios where I'm seeing the Eagles or David Gates from Bread. Remember Bread?
I remember Bread.
Heat Wave. Ray Parker Jr. built a really great studio with the money from Ghostbusters, the theme song that he wrote, and going to studio after studio after studio and seeing these people in the business repairing their equipment and getting a sense of my place in the business. It was very fortunate.
Speaking of your place, how unusual was it at the time for a woman to be in this industry? Did you have contemporaries who were in the same field, or were you often the only woman?
Oh, there weren't women maintenance techs.
None.
It was extremely rare. Hmm. As someone told me once that there was one in Australia. That's how rare it was. They're just
like a mythical creature almost.
There weren't that many. I remember the first time I went to a radio station in Los Angeles to fix their tape machine, and I was in my early 20s, and I loved punk and I loved disco. So I had my disco queen high heels on, but I had blue stripes in my hair, And
are you a fan of the Rolling Stones album Some Girls? That yes. They kind of tried to do the same.
Yes.
Yeah, the punk and the disco, yeah. Little shout out for the Rolling Stones. Out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
I remember the look on the gentleman's face who was the studio owner, and he was white-haired, and he looked at me like I had 10 heads. And he went around the corner to call my boss, and I heard him say, "What the hell is this?" And my boss...
Because you were a woman.
Well, I didn't fit the picture. I mean, I didn't look like anything he'd ever seen before, and I was going to be working on his tape machine. And you know what? I can understand his perspective. Unusual sights are frightening, and that was an unusual sight. And he was old guard, you know, he'd never seen this before. So my boss, Keith Skiving, says, "Calm down. She knows what she's doing. Let her work on the machine. If she can't fix it, she'll call one of us. Either way, your machine's going to get fixed." So I did repair the machine. The problem wasn't that difficult. I found it and I fixed it and had a conversation with the guy and I left. And Keith told me afterward, the guy called him and said, "You know, she's a little wet behind the ears, but she's all right." But, you know, that taught me to meet them halfway. I put the disco shoes in the closet and let the hair grow out normally. I want to fit in. I don't want to make a point. That's my perspective. I'm not thinking that's how it should be done,
right.
But that was the right move for me. It felt right, and I'm glad I did it. Being able to see what they saw when they saw me and being someone who could fit in rather than challenge the mold. That doesn't mean I had to wear plaid shirts. I wore one with Prince one day, and he sent me home to change. Susan, where'd you get that stupid shirt?
Glad he's not here today, because yeah, I'd have to go change.
Well, he didn't want any women working for him looking
right.
like guys, but
right.
yeah, I wanted to cooperate.
That's interesting. I assume there are worse stories that you might have encountered than the one you just told us about obstacles or resistance to you working in this field.
No, that's the great thing about being a technician is that the tape machine doesn't care what kind of shoes you're wearing.
Right.
You're the fixer, you don't. This
right.
is the joy of being in the sciences rather than the arts. In the arts, it's more judgmental.
Mm.
But everyone, well, over 40 years in the business, all the men that I encountered were welcoming and were good to me. They trained me. They gave me my first and early breaks. After Audio Industries, I was with them about 3 years. I was hired by a studio called Rudy Records. That was Graham Nash and David Crosby. They were happy to have me as their technician. And I began to think, you know, like others talk about, this is a feature, not a bug.
Right.
You want a woman technician because
right.
you're going to have something that the other guys don't have. This is a feature, not a bug. And to see it as, yeah, I can do everything they do, and I got this thing going on too, that's helpful.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your work with Graham Nash and David Crosby at their studio. You went from being a maintenance tech, as you say, to doing what there exactly? Did you begin audio engineering there or similar kind
no,
of work?
No, I was their studio technician. I would occasionally assist
yeah.
when their regular assistant was busy. It was just a small one-room studio, but we had some of the best of LA's, that soft rock scene, which included the Eagles and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Kris Kristofferson and Bonnie Raitt, and those folks were all colleagues. Al Cooper was there quite a lot.
Nice.
Yeah. David Lindley, of course. And
so they would. Your role then was simply to... What was your
role?
Keep
the equipment running.
Okay.
Repair the console, repair the tape machine, repair microphones, outboard gear, tune the room, monitors if that needed to happen.
So just a lot of hands-on.
Keep the studio,
yeah.
Yes, keep the studio running.
Okay, and how long were you there?
About 2.5 years.
2.5 years there and picking up all these skills, but not really being an engineer, but observing how engineering and production
yes.
worked. Okay.
Yeah, helping out. But no, I was never in that engineering chair.
Do you recall what kind of takeaways you had from just observing, just given your trajectory and where you ended up going with your work? Do you remember any key things you picked up from the role of an engineer or a producer at that studio?
Somewhat. I didn't get to observe it too much.
Okay.
But it was something that was that had a lot of impact on me was seeing how the old guard worked. Because Jackson Browne and all of the folks who worked at that studio were from an earlier era, kind of the golden era of rock and roll.
Right.
And what was coming up and what I was a fan of, because I was a young woman in my 20s, was this new wave. And so Blondie and Talking Heads and
yeah.
Prince, I was a huge Prince fan, that was coming up.
Right.
The other thing that was coming up, it's not unlike what's going on today, is drum machines. And synthesizers.
Right. Synthesizers, yeah.
And I remember so many session drummers really worried in the early 1980s of, are we going to work anymore? There's drum machines, and everyone wants drum machines, and everything you hear on commercial radio is drum machine. And the horn players and the string players saying, we're going to be out of work.
I like, it's not, I don't like it, but it's fascinating that as humans, there are different cycles in which we have been threatened by robots.
Yeah.
Like, we're all like worried about automation now. But that's a whole other level. And we're cyborgs with our phones, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
But that's interesting to hear that those were the early musical robots that were threatening the livelihoods of
Yes,
of
in the early 80s. And what's interesting is that our students today sometimes complain at Berkeley that we make them do sessions where they have to record drums. And they're telling us, you know, you guys, that's like old school. But
I'm a drummer. This is very bad news.
In the history of popular music, anytime we add a new technology, we don't automatically get rid of the old one. The tree is getting denser at the top of the branches.
It seems to me that a new technology emerges. We muck around with it as a civilization for a few years. And then someone sometime at a point decides, you know, I'm going to go back to the way we used to do it. And then that becomes a thing again. So
yeah.
Like live drums becomes a thing again. Phew. Thankfully.
Yeah. When typewriters came along, it didn't wipe out pencils and pens.
Yeah, that's true.
We still have them.
Yeah, we do. It's true. Okay. We've solved that one. Good. Done. So you worked there at that studio for 2.5 years, you say, roughly.
Yeah.
What happens next?
My dream came true. I was Prince was my favorite artist in the world. I had seen him several times play in Los Angeles, and I had all his records. He was my favorite artist. And the boyfriend that I mentioned before, he was an ex-boyfriend at this point, but we were very close, and he called me up, and with his thick Boston accent, he was the chief tech at Westlake Audio, and he says to me, Sue, your dream job is waiting for you. Sue, call Glenn at Westlake. Sue, Prince is looking for a technician. That's your job. Call him. And I still remember the phone call. And I called John's boss, and I said, Glenn, I hear that Prince is looking for a technician. How do I get this job? And short version of the story is he interviewed me, and Prince's management interviewed me, and they hired me, and I moved to Minnesota.
Well, had you interacted with Prince in any way beyond being a fan before
no.
that? Okay, so did you say Prince interviewed you or the management?
No, his management.
Okay. So what's your first memory of meeting Prince, if I might ask?
My first memory of seeing him up close, this is so bad. Oh, I wish this hadn't happened. He was wearing a towel and a shower cap. It's one of those moments you just wish you could erase.
Just to be clear, had he just come out of the shower, or was that just an outfit he decided?
No, he had just come out of the shower.
Okay, just making sure, because that would be weird if he just walked around like that all the time.
No. And he was actually, he was shy, and
yes.
He was personally very conservative, as a lot of folks in Minnesota are. It could have been terrible. I don't know if he saw me, but I saw him. So I had just arrived, and I was in the driveway of his home in Chanhassen, Minnesota. And I had been working in the studio downstairs, but I needed to use the restroom. And I asked his personal assistant, Sandy Scipione, can I use the restroom? Is there one here? And she says, yeah, go in through the front door. And I opened the front door, and it was this split-level home that had a half staircase going up to the right and another half staircase down on the left. And he was just coming across that landing. So I opened the front door, and this little figure went flying past in a towel and shower cap. And I'm like, oh, no. Don't let it start like this. But we didn't actually meet then. That
okay.
was my first time seeing him
okay.
up close.
Okay.
But our first meeting actually took place about a week later. He had me down in the basement. His home studio was just a bedroom in the basement of this
home. Before Paisley Park, by the way, right?
Oh, yeah. Paisley didn't come online until 87. This was 83. So he had just come off the 1999 tour, and he's getting ready to do Purple Rain, which is why he hired a technician. He was going to need somebody. Anyway, I had been in his room for about a week installing a new console and repairing things. Still hadn't met him, but I could hear him upstairs, because right above the studio was where the dining room was, and that's where the piano was, just where the dining room meets the living room. I don't know if you've heard the album that came out recently called A Piano and a Microphone, 1983.
Yeah.
And you hear him on piano? That was him every day. That was what you heard anytime you're setting up microphones and he's waiting for you to mic a drum kit or waiting for you to set something up or you're editing something. That was him on piano.
His work ethic had a profound impact on you. It was very influential on you. And it, I mean, my understanding is you barely slept because you were at his beck and call, really, because he was so creative at that point, right? That's about right?
Yeah. I've come to understand a little bit more about the neurobiology of creativity. I won't bore you with the details of that, but...
Please do.
Oh, you wanted... Okay, well... creativity, I've been researching this lately, and it's really interesting. Creativity is more born than made, and it's dependent upon two structures. One is called the right precuneus, and the other is the right parietal temporal junction. The names don't matter, but they're over here on the right side where we tend to be creative. Essentially, the way it works is, if you need to do something creative, like write a song or anything that you might do, where you're looking at a blank page and you have to think of something creative, you have to consciously, willingly open that right precuneus to let the ideas come. Mm. And for most of us, I'll speak about myself because I think I'm pretty average in this regard, creativity is really hard work. So I'll open the gate and I'll let ideas come if I have to write a presentation or whatever. As soon as a good idea comes, we shut the gate. And we switch from art to craft. Okay, good. That idea is going to work. This is good. You shut the gate, and now it's craft. Now I have to build the thing that I just created in my mind's eye or ear. Then you open up this other circuit, and when you're doing that, as your craft is coming through, you're constantly separating into two piles, good idea, bad idea, good idea, bad idea, works, doesn't work, works, doesn't work, until you have the finished product. In highly creative people, those two circuits are slightly defective.
Defective.
They show reduced deactivation, meaning the gates don't close.
Right.
They've got leaky faucets. So Prince, I believe now, must have had two leaky faucets there, because one, when it comes to separating relevant from irrelevant information to a very creative person, they leave that door open. Even if they've come up with a good idea, they leave it open, just in case a better idea comes along. The rest of us shut the gate. But Prince was constantly, constantly, constantly thinking of new songs, which is why we had to work those 24-hour sessions. Sometimes we'd sleep a few hours and do another one. Sometimes we wouldn't sleep at all. One time in particular, we finished basically a 24-hour session. He goes upstairs to brush his teeth at home studio. I'm putting everything away, and he comes back down, and he says, "Can we go another round? I was just brushing my teeth," and he was brushing his teeth, and he thought of a song. He didn't write music, so if he thought of it, he had to record it.
Was the song that he came up with dentally oriented? It about his teeth?
No, it was a groove. He said he was brushing his teeth, and this groove came to him.
I see.
And songs can start with a groove. With him, he would sometimes start by programming a drum machine or playing a drum kit. Or songs can start, of course, the way they normally do, with just melody. Or it can be a lyrical idea. And he would start his songs with, you know, any of those three.
When Prince passed away, we started to hear about this archive, this treasure trove of material. I feel like I heard it was in a vault, for crying out loud. Like, it was this highly protected treasure trove of material. You were a witness to this period, prolific period. Can you estimate how much material we haven't heard from that period? Just based on your 24-hour cycle of working, like, we're getting deluxe editions of albums. I know the Purple Rain deluxe edition is quite massive, and there's all these songs that some of us had never heard before. Do you have a sense of what we are in for if this stuff comes out? Like, is it a lot of stuff?
Well, I had a sense 2 years ago when he passed away, and I've come to understand that I needed to change my what I thought. I was asked this question when he first passed away. I was the person who started the vault. I needed to start a vault for him when I went to work for him. So I knew how it was when we started it. I heard from others who worked with him after I left how big it had grown to be. You couldn't shut the door on it because it was so full. It was just spilling out. It was spilling everywhere. So my estimate was for every Prince song we knew, there were at least two more that you hadn't heard. But after he passed away, I since learned that so much of his material had leaked through a bootleg chain that there were bootleggers around the world who had, in the words of one, when I had a Skype conversation with him, he said, looking right into the camera, he looked at me and he said, "We have everything. We have everything." And they damn near do. So the hardcore collectors have heard 90% of it. It's very rare that one pops up out of the vault that hasn't been leaked at some point in Prince's history.
This is through some nefarious staffing thing like this.
There was all that. There were mistakes that Prince made. He used to, this is good. You'd make him a cassette, right? Like a rough mix. And he'd get in the car and he'd drive around in that Thunderbird that he had for a while there, and he'd play the rough mix and he'd eject the cassette and he'd throw it in the back seat. And he was doing this all the time.
Just chucking tapes behind him?
Into the back seat of the car.
Right, yeah.
But his assistant would take the car to be washed and detailed every other day, and those guys at that car wash were cleaning him out. They were cleaning out those cassettes and putting them probably in trash bags. Then, of course, there were a lot of girlfriends. Prince had a lot of girlfriends, and he'd say, "Here, baby, I made this for you." He'd give her a cassette. She'd leave it sitting around at home. Her new boyfriend comes over, sees that sitting there, and it walks out of her apartment. There was also a member of Prince's later band after the Revolution who we found out through some clever technical manipulation. They found where the leak was, and there was a member of the band that was copying and passing on just about everything.
That's a drag.
Really sad. Really sad.
Yeah. Well, we've jumped ahead a little bit here. I want to get back to this period where you begin to work as a technician. You're hired to be a technician. You're hired by Prince to do ostensibly what you had been doing in these other the last job you had, but that changed quickly, right? Your role as a technician changed, my understanding is, in a moment, basically, when he had an idea, right? Can you describe that?
Yes, I had done all this tech work for him. I assumed he had an engineer. I didn't think to ask. But when we finally got everything ready to roll, he was really eager to get down into the studio and record, and he asked me to set up a vocal mic.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
And he told me which one he wanted, the big tube U-47. And I set up the mic and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be bad. Because any second now, I just know an engineer is going to walk through this back door and be really upset with me for doing what I'm not supposed to do, which is set up a vocal mic. That's the engineer's job. But, well, Prince is my boss. He asked me to do it. So I set up the vocal mic and I'm still waiting for the engineer. And Prince had me put up the tape. It was Mia Boca by Jill Jones. And I don't think he asked me to get a rough mix, but he might have. But he was asking me to do things like the engineer is supposed to do. And I keep thinking, well, maybe the engineer is late, so maybe that's my excuse. And finally I asked him, who's going to engineer it? And he said, you. And I went, okay. And I just took the chair. And that was my first engineering gig, is working with him.
It's a remarkable story. You set up the console, right? You were saying that you came in and you implemented the console. You're a technician. Now suddenly you're an engineer. This means operating the console. Did you have any sense of how to do it before he said you're going to be the engineer? Like, there's obvious things in terms of settings and faders and whatnot, but is that the first time you'd ever actually done that?
For all intents and purposes, yes. Now, I knew signal flow. So I didn't need to be taught how to do things, but I certainly needed to be taught what to do. Mm. Prince had a very specific sound, and he liked things panned a certain way, and I knew his ear because I had all his albums, but it took some time for me to learn what he wanted and to be able to manipulate a console so that the sound that came out was his sound.
Do you recall what that first piece of music was? Is it something that became...
The first thing he had me put up for that recording was Mia Bocca on a Jill Jones
album. Oh, right, you were saying, right.
But the first thing I heard of his, and I'll never, ever, ever forget this, prior to that session was he had me put up the multitrack of Darling Nikki, and I pushed up the faders. And it was a small little bedroom studio. Darling Nikki is this thunderously large song on the Purple Rain album. And I'm all alone in this little bedroom, these big Westlake monitors right in front of me. And I'm a Prince fan, hearing a song off the new Prince album. And there's the tape machine right there. And I just remember kind of looking around like, is anybody else here? It just seemed like, you know, picture your wildest dream.
Yeah.
And then picture it coming true. It was that moment.
It's remarkable. Yeah. So you are beginning work on what becomes the Purple Rain album. He primarily plays most of the instruments on a lot of these songs. Is that correct?
On Purple Rain, yeah.
So he's doing everything, really? Like, there's no one else? He's playing the drums, he's doing all, and it's just you two
one
there?
One instrument at a time. Often, when we were home in Minneapolis, it was just the two of us, often. Sometimes we'd record at rehearsal with the whole band, The Revolution. And then Prince's favorite studio was Sunset Sound in Los Angeles.
Right.
So when we went out to Sunset, we would work with staff engineer Peggy McCreary. Mm-hmm. So it was Peggy and me and Prince, the three of us.
Okay. So what is your... we've talked about his... And I know the Prince looms large in your story. I don't want to dwell too much on him, but you did mention the creative aspect of his brain and the floodgates. How much did the songs change from his initial idea? And, like, you know, when he's playing for the first time, did he have a solid sense of the song right away? Like, was there a lot of modification to his idea or no?
He was a really unusual musical animal. So if he wrote a song and he wanted it to be played on acoustic drums, he would work out the chord changes and the melody on piano. He'd write out the lyrics. Then he'd leave me a note, usually on the console, or sometimes he'd just call and say what he wanted set up. I'd have everything set up and ready to go, including the sound that he wanted. Sometimes it would be tight, dry reverb. Sometimes it would be long reverbs, just whatever the song called for. But he wanted to be able to walk downstairs, sit at the drum kit, he'd take the lyric sheet and he'd tape it to a stand. I had the stand ready for him, so the lyric sheet is right here. And then he would play the song from top to bottom on drums with no other accompaniment, with no click. He'd play the song in his head, with every break, with every fill in his head on drums. He'd get off the drums, come back into the control room, hand him the bass, which of course has to be tuned and ready to go, so that he can play back the drums and play the bass part, which is in his head already. And then the basic rhythm parts, the melody, lead vocal, backing vocals, and then the ornamentation. And we're mixing as we go along, and then you print the mix. Most songs went like that. There were some exceptions. The bigger songs got reworked, things like The Beautiful Ones and Computer Blue, and You Got the Look was reworked. Sign of the Times was one of his bigger songs, and that was almost like through composed. I mean, it's just from the beginning to the final mix in a one-day session. Nothing compares to you. Kiss. Well, Kiss had a collaborator. That was David Rivkin over at the other studio. But when Prince got it back from David Rivkin, these things just went so fast through him.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it really was.
Have you thought much about the one aspect that I see a parallel between you and Prince here is you two are both independent spirits on some level. Do you think of yourself as a control freak at all, by the way?
No.
You seem very laid back and chill, but there's an aspect of controlling your destiny that I hear in your story about trying to take ownership of your path. And when I hear what you're saying about Prince doing everything himself, and we, you know, fascinatingly, when he died, the floodgates opened in terms of his music. Suddenly the music was available on streaming services and things. And he resisted all of that. He very famously fought his record label. He very famously prohibited people from posting his music online without his consent. He was very controlling, I think, is one word. I respected it. I never viewed that. I don't view controlling as a negative thing. When I hear you talk about him producing this music all on his own, well, with you, that speaks to some connection I feel like you two might have. This notion of my path is my path, and I'm in charge of this, and I'm going to control this, and I don't need external consideration for what I'm doing on some level.
You know what I think that is? I think the thing he and I had in common was we had a really tiny safety net. And that's what that is. Like, the desire for control depends, I think, on whether or not you've got a safety net under you when you're on that tightrope. When Prince embarked on his career, it was be successful or be nothing. And this was a kid who had worked like a fiend when he was a child in order to be successful, because he was homeless when he was 14 years old. His divorcing parents kicked him out. His stepfather locked him in a room for days on end. And the kid had a really rough, rough childhood. He had to be successful. So when you're on that tightrope and there's no safety net, you walk really carefully but determinedly and without pause, because you can't afford to fail. And for myself, starting, getting kind of a rough start, good parents, but bad circumstances.
There's pain.
Yeah, and it puts you out on that tightrope, and you're like, oh, this is going to work. This is going to work, and I'm going to see to it that I rely on myself to make it work. You're not begging the universe or other people to give you a break.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. That hadn't occurred to me until you told these mm-hmm. stories. So which records of Prince's did you work on? And my understanding is the trajectory of your working relationship was about 83 to 87. Is that mm-hmm. correct? So which for people who don't know, what material or what albums does that encompass?
It's amazing. In those 4 years, it was Purple Rain, then Around the World in a Day, and then Parade, and then Sign of the Times, and all but one of the songs on the Black Album.
Okay. And you would often tour with him to capture live shows? And
yeah, I was his full-time employee, so whatever he was doing, I was doing.
And did you live at his house?
No.
But you barely went home?
I barely went home.
Yeah. Did you have to... You had a house? You had a...
Apartment.
It was a nice apartment? I'm just making conversation now. I don't know why I'm asking about this.
No, it was nice. I didn't see too much of it. But I you know,
you ostensibly lived at Prince's house.
We were together every day.
Every day.
That's for sure.
So a very close relationship. And you've detailed this before, but for those who haven't heard it, why did this relationship end?
Oh, I don't know. And maybe I kind of do know. I think we could kind of sense it coming. We did so much work in that intense, highly concentrated period, but Prince is an artist. He needed his world. He needed his environment to change. Everything inspires you, and if everything is the same, where's your inspiration going to come from? The revolution had left. He had cut off his engagement with Susanna Melvoin. Paisley Park had just gotten built and opened its doors, so for the first time in our time together, he could now have a staff of engineers, not just me.
Oh.
So the timing was kind of right. I was also just pretty wiped out. I had done 15 years worth of work in going on 5 years now. And it was time for me, I think, to fly and have a life beyond him. And it was time for him to have new methodologies and new working partners.
Right. Okay. It's as simple as that on some level. Did you keep in touch with him after that relationship?
A little bit, because I would go back to Paisley Park. Clients would hire me to work at Paisley, to mix or to do things at Paisley. So I would see him from time to time. The last time I saw him was in the late 90s. I was on tour with a band, Gegita, and we were in Minneapolis. We went into Glam Slam one evening, and Prince was there. It was always a real pleasure to see him. I had deep love for him, and he did for me. There was a lot of affection there. We were both not outwardly affectionate people, but there was certainly a lot of love.
I see. Okay. So you leave Prince, and what happens next? What are you doing after that? You're flying free, but I assume you're unsure of where you're flying to.
Yeah. In this business, you have to work for 7 years before you can call yourself a beginner. And at this point, when I left Prince, I had been in it 10 years. I moved back to Los Angeles in the spring of 88, and that was 10 years since I had begun. I'd begun in 78. So I embarked on a career as an independent engineer and mixer and producer, eventually getting asked to produce more and more. And that's what I did for the next 12 years until I had this major hit with Bare Naked Ladies.
So who did you work with in that time frame?
Right after Prince, the first gig I had was with the Jacksons, which was really interesting. I
worked with Michael?
No, the album 2300 Jackson Street. So it was with Jermaine and Tito and Jackie and all the rest of the brothers. And hearing stories of their Motown childhood and how they came up and how Michael came up and comparing them with Prince stories of how he came up was really interesting, because they both reached the same pinnacle on the pop charts, but with two completely different starting points. So, yeah, I worked with them, and then I did a lot of alternative indie stuff. There was Michael Penn and Jill Sobule and records like that. Mm-hmm. My life changed when I met Tommy Jordan and Greg Kirsten, and I worked on 3 Gegita albums. I worked with The Odds in Vancouver, and then, of course, Bare Naked Ladies and Tricky and Hugh Harris and David Byrne and Rusted Root and quite a variety.
Yeah, quite a variety. I don't mean to travel back in time after we've moved on, but I feel like since you brought up the Jacksons, it's Jermaine, no pun intended. Did Prince, Jesse got that one. Jermaine Jackson, anyone? You're too young. Anyway, so did Prince view Michael Jackson as a rival?
Yes, and was really happy about that.
He's happy he had someone, a foil.
Oh, sure. Yeah, as I'm sure Michael was too. That's what you want.
Yeah. Okay. I just wondered. There's the infamous, you mentioned James Brown earlier. There's the infamous clip of James Brown performing a show and bringing Michael and Prince up on stage to do some stuff. And the consensus is that Michael shone in that moment and that Prince struggled.
Yeah, that was bad. That was one of...
Were you around for that?
No, that was before me. It was one of the most embarrassing moments in Prince's life. If you can Google it.
And this is coming from 82. A guy that walked around with a towel and a shower cap a lot of the time.
He didn't walk around. He was running.
Sorry.
Anyway, it was an accident. No, Prince wasn't quite ready. And, you know, like we say, we want the spotlight of attention to fall on you when you're ready, not when you're stepping into your underwear. But, you know, you've got to try.
Yeah.
And Prince was invited on stage by Michael Jackson. It was actually James Brown's stage. And Prince wasn't quite savvy enough at this young point in his career to prevent himself from making a very bad mistake. Something you never do. You never will do, but back then, you just don't do it. You don't get on stage with Michael Jackson and dance. You're going down. And Prince knew better, because first he gets on stage with these two guys. Here's his rival and his hero. Imagine being a young man, he's maybe 23 years old, on stage with your chief rival and your hero.
Yeah.
And there's a camera on you. And he's trying to sing like James Brown, yeah, but James Brown is right there. Okay, so he aborts that. Then, all right, well, let me just play guitar. All right, yeah, I'm playing guitar, but that's not interesting because you've got James Brown and Michael Jackson here. So he takes off the guitar, and then he thinks, I know, I'll dance. Oh, you don't do that because Michael can, on one toe, give you five spins. And then Prince, you know, realizes, I just better say goodnight, folks. And as he's leaving the stage, he knocks over a prop.
Yes.
He knocked over that big light.
This is all on YouTube,
but,
by the way.
Let me say, though, I watched him, Prince, watch that clip over and over
again. I was going to ask if you ever talked about this moment with him, and you're saying he watched a lot.
Yeah. He internalized even his most embarrassing moments to know what not to do.
Yeah.
He was a really courageous guy.
That's how you learn.
That's how you learn.
That's how you learn. You listen to yourself. You watch yourself. I know some people are like, I never watch my, never hear my songs. I never, but that's how you learn, I think. You learn from your mistakes more than your victories on some level. Anyway, you mentioned, thank you for going back in time to that horrible time for Prince. But I do, I, yeah. it was noteworthy.
I admire him so much for the courage that he showed in so many ways in his career.
Yeah. So this other life-altering moment for you occurs. In some ways, it's unlikely because of Toronto's Bare Naked Ladies. So tell me about that working relationship. How did that come about? You obviously have cachet and credibility because of Prince. You mentioned the other list of people you've worked with. How did you, who are notable as well, how did you come to work with the Bare Naked Ladies?
Well, they had sent me, after the first album came out, they sent me demos for their second record. And this
the
was
first album is Gordon?
Yes, after Gordon, they sent me demos for the second record. And I listened to Gordon and I liked it, but I was pretty booked up and I was kind of going in a more alternative direction at that time. So I told my manager that I wasn't interested. But
your punk roots are still
They were showing a little bit.
Yeah.
But we had some mutual friends in Odds and in Toad the Wet Sprocket out in Santa Barbara and eventually Gagita. And so the ladies were, to my good fortune, they asked me again. So they asked me before the stunt record if I would be ready. And at this point, I really was ready to work with them. And I had 3 weeks available in January and February.
Okay.
So we worked together. And we had almost no time for pre-production. They had all the songs written except for 1 week. 1 week was written at the very last point.
Which ends up being this massive single.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. That sometimes at
the best idea is at the
end. When you finally realize you've got a record, the pressure is reduced, and suddenly it just pours out. Sometimes
I often hear that the record label will say, "Thanks for what you sent in. You're missing a single. What are you going to do about it?" Did that happen with them? Or
not
no?
that I know of.
Okay.
No.
So one of the most iconic musical moments of our time. It has been memed. It has been studied, I think, by scientists, is from this song, 1 Week, where Ed Robertson says, "It's been," and then nothing happens. I can't believe I'm asking you about this, but tell us about that song and that moment, because it has been pondered, and it's used on Twitter quite a bit. I noticed that people use it as kind of this joke on some level, but this is a huge song. What do you remember about the composition of this song and that decision to be like, whatever, it's been...
That was their arrangement. That was their decision. My contribution had a lot to do with the rhythm section.
Oh, okay.
They told me then that one of the things they wanted the record to achieve was to sell more in the States, because they were so well known in Canada, but they wanted to sell more in the States. And for that, The rhythm has to go a little bit differently. The groove, the pocket needs to be a little bit different. Fewer tom fills. Sometimes you just stay right in that zone. You stay right in that pocket, and you don't break form, or the rhythm section doesn't. You let the top line break, but the bottom line needs to stay. So we needed to get Tyler off the toms a little bit and onto work cymbals a little differently. So the decision to do 1 Week with acoustic guitar was something that they wanted to do. That was their choice. And the breaks, I think it just happened naturally.
Okay.
I had an album right before that record and another one immediately after. So I was really busy and I could only come to Toronto for a couple of pre-productions where they ran down what they had been rehearsing. We made whatever changes we needed to make.
Okay. So are you an engineer or producer on that record? How would you describe your your role?
Both. I'm credited with co-production on it, and I engineered it as well. And then after my 3 weeks were up, I handed it off to David Leonard, who did the remaining overdubs and more vocals and mixed it.
Is that distinction between engineering and producing one that you feel is muddled or misunderstood, this notion that you are...
It was pretty cut and dry back in those days, but now it's pretty hybrid. So in those days, the engineer was analogous to the cameraman on a film.
Right.
Cameraman plus art director, responsible for massaging sound. And the producer was responsible for realizing the vision and for helping to form that vision, making arrangement choices and for pulling performances out of musicians. That's what we do. And for being on that talk back and saying when we got it or no, we need to keep going.
It's a technical role.
Yeah, they're two different things. At this point, the only way that I could engineer and produce simultaneously is that I knew engineering so well that I could do it automatically. And that freed up another part of the brain that allowed me to listen with the listener's ear.
Right. So from what I've read, I mentioned that this relationship with the Bare Naked Ladies and the success of this album was life-altering for you. From what I've read, you viewed the success and the money that you earned from it as almost a way out of what you were doing as an engineer, as a technician, and that instead you thought, okay, I'm going to take this money and I'm going to go to school. Is that accurate?
Yes. When you'd have a hit record back in those days before Napster, before evil file sharing, producers and artists got royalty checks. And if you had a hit record like this was, multi-platinum, you had a big royalty check. So you could pay off your mortgage or you can build a recording studio or do what I did, which is quit my job.
Like a lottery ticket almost.
Well, I had been, since my mid-30s, I began feeling a second calling, the calling to go to college and be in the sciences. I thought I would really enjoy that line of work. And the voice was just getting louder and louder. By the time I was in my 40s, when we did that record, it was a pretty loud voice. I was no longer listening to college radio. I was in my mid-40s, and I thought I would enjoy
the... Is that
when
that happens? Am I going to stop listening to college radio?
No, I don't know. It does for some people. I remember I was working with T-Bone Burnett. We were at the Magic Shop in New York, and he was being interviewed, and the interviewer asked him, do you listen to college radio? And he says, hell no, I don't listen to college radio. I'm 47 years old. There'd be something wrong with me if I listened to college radio. And I was just 3 years younger than he, and I thought, yeah, I'm feeling this too. Like,
right.
I'm no longer as excited about the records. At least the genre of music that I'm making. I'm more interested in jazz, and you know, my tastes are changing.
Is that in your work as a cognitive scientist, is that something that I wondered about that, this notion of aging out of music, listening to music, and aging out of this impulse I have to discover new music, and I wonder where it comes from, because I think it's a lack of time. I don't think that's happened to me yet, but I hear of this happening. I know it's a phenomenon that will occur. As a parent of two children, as someone who has 6-7 types of jobs, one of them happens to be processing new music, so that's lucky. But I imagine at some point my mental capacity for processing something as vibrant and new might change. Is there something in my wiring? Examine me and let me know what's happening?
It probably won't change. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow.
I have to wait till tomorrow?
Yes. But no,
you're just like my actual doctor.
greater detail. Our appetite for music and our preferences is driven by gene expression, and so is personality. And those tend to be fairly stable over a lifetime. What isn't stable over a lifetime is things like resting arousal rate.
Right.
So for example, Adrian North did this work. He showed that there are two groups of people who have almost the exact same personality profile. They only differ according to age. Young men who like heavy metal and older men who like classical music. It's the same personality profile. It's just that when you're young, you're into heavy metal. As you get older, your resting arousal rate slows down a little bit. You still want the same experience. You want complexity.
Virtuosity.
In your music. Right. You want virtuosity. Yeah. You want an active, not passive, music listening experience. You're just older and you've kind of been there, done that. So you're seeking newer experiences. But the core of what you like will remain the same. just as your appetite for food will remain the same.
Right, okay.
If you're adventurous as a foodie, you'll be adventurous your whole life. And if you're not a risk taker with food, that'll persist your whole life.
It sounds to me that you were physically exhausted by your work as much as you were mentally exhausted, and you had this voice calling you somewhere else. So where did that voice lead you that you were talking about after?
I just thought I would really enjoy going to school and studying, and that same engineering mind wanted to keep engineering, but with a new input source.
Different engineering.
System.
Yeah.
And I became very attracted to neuroscience. I really wanted to do brain science. So I did 4 years at the University of Minnesota with the money that I got from my royalty checks.
Back in Minnesota. Interesting.
Yeah, back to Minnesota. I love the U of M. And then I was fortunate to be accepted into McGill. It's the world's center. It's the mecca for music cognition and music perception research. And I was accepted in Daniel Levitin's lab.
Okay.
So I did 4 years at McGill.
So you were exhausted by music on one level. On another, you wanted to dig deeper into it. You wanted to know how it worked more than...
Oh, yeah.
That's fascinating.
No, I love record making. I love engineering. I love production. I love mixing. I'm jealous of the kids who get to do it now. But I had my day.
Yeah.
I had all the fun I wanted to have. It's their turn. They should do this now.
I can't help but wonder if your studies are some sort of self-examination of why you have had these impulses in your life to take the path you've had, because you're a music fan, and I think some of what you're correct me if I'm wrong, but I imagine some of what you're studying is why a person relates to music in a certain way. How it helps them, how it alters their mind, how it alters their brain chemistry on some level. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking of it. But I think of it a little bit more like, it's like being in love. Music and I made a commitment to it. And I was its partner. And I loved it. And I was good to it. And I served it well. But I began getting interested in somebody else. I began getting interested in the sciences.
The nerd version of it.
Right. So here was my partner that had been good to me.
Yeah.
And I really kind of hated to leave music. But at the same time, this other voice was, there was something there. It was getting louder and louder. And so this new partner, the sciences, I honestly love as much as I loved working in music. It is... to my good fortune that they are complementary.
Yeah.
I like teaching students at Berkeley we can talk about record making from, you know, the artist or the production or the engineering or mixing aspect. We can also talk about record making from the consumer's point of view, mm-hmm. and that's the brain science of it. So the conversation is like having a conversation about family in a way.
Yeah.
Like these are things I love and things I feel like I know, as we feel like we know our partners or our loved ones, but we don't really know.
Yeah.
And it's always nice when there's a little bit of mystery there. So I think it's more like you mentioned self-discovery. It kind of feels like other discovery too. You're discovering something about something you love.
Are you in your work kind of in touch with how music consumption is working these days? And well, I ask this because... And I've had a couple of dark conversations since I came to Ottawa, like a thunder cloud, a dark cloud, saying everything is in kind of a bad shape on some level. I don't mean it. I'm ultimately an optimistic, hopeful person. That's why I do things like what we're doing today, and why I make a music-oriented podcast, and why I go to shows and listen to music with my kids. Like, I love music, but. There is something going on, I think, and I don't know if your work will speak to this in terms of how the general population seems to have devalued music on some level. Like, on some level, these streaming services and whatnot are very popular. And on some level, I feel like people have more access to music than they've ever had. Musicians have more access to their fans because of the internet than they've ever had. But at the same time, musicians are struggling a lot more on some level to make ends meet with it, because it used to be a song came on the radio in a major market, and it maybe a million people heard that song, And if 10% of those people went out and bought the record, the artist would do quite well. And now it's people often post their streaming numbers, and it says 300 million people, or well, that's an exaggeration, 4 million people heard my song. Well, how many people bought that song in the end? How did that come back to the artist? And so I wonder if you, in your work, cover this at all, the way we consume music and have, like, a lot of us still buy music, I think, and a lot of us support, probably the people here are engaged in music making because they love it, but it seems like a fraught time. Yeah. That's arguable. I know a lot of people will push back against what I'm saying and say, well, you know, I guess those musicians just need to get another job as well, and that's a different outlook than I'm used to. Do you have any thoughts on that? Have you pondered that?
I have thoughts on it, but I haven't read any scientific findings about where things are going. Most scientists are interested in, ones I read anyway, are interested in brain science. So I don't know too much about social psychology. Okay. So I don't know those papers, but I certainly have thoughts on it from my personal perspective and that of my colleagues and our students and our graduates at Berkeley. Music is going in kind of the opposite direction that food went. So years ago, not that long ago, people did not go out to eat. You bought groceries and you made food at home. It was a pretty rare occasion for the majority of people where you would go out to eat.
Everyone, it was a special occasion.
It was a special occasion, yeah. You made food. That's what you did. But as our society advanced and as people got really, really busy, in today's world, it's rare that you make food at home. People eat fast food and they order out. You're having someone else do something for you that you could do for yourself, but you're saying, you know what? The way you make that sandwich is better than how I would make it, and I'm willing to give you money to make me a sandwich. That's where we've come. But in music, it's gone the opposite direction. The price of admission to be able to make music in the middle of the last century was really, really high. You had to have a specialized knowledge or skill. You had to be a producer or an engineer, or you had to be signed to a record deal. You had to afford the money to go into a big recording studio. Not that many people could make music. That was a big deal. Now, if you've got a laptop, you can be a recording artist. So now, in the opposite direction, people are saying, why would I pay you to make music for me? I can make my own music. So I think we've got everyone making artisanal music now. Hmm. I think that human nature being what it is, we will go back to realize, you know, yeah, I can make my own music, or I can listen to my friend's music, or my roommate's, or my brother's music, but I'd rather pay for the music that that guy makes, because I think it's better. I think the marketplace of ideas will sift, once again, these objects. Mm. And music used to be the rare gold in this pan. And now we're seeing, like, okay, it's in the pan. We've got gold, but we've got a lot of other stuff that we like, namely our own music.
Right.
And we, I think we need to get back to that point where we are beginning to have a value system that recognizes that some people do make food or music better than others. Is it worth paying for? What I'm observing at Berkeley, and what seems to be the story now, is that things are on the upswing. We're hearing, with each passing year, better stories from our graduates out in Los Angeles. I'm hearing about recording studios being built, this new studio called Gold Digger, which is 9 rooms in Los Angeles, 9 rooms that are working.
Yeah.
And if new studios are being built, that means that someone's crunched the numbers and someone has said, I can make a profit off this. More of our graduates are getting work and are winning awards and are moving up the chain faster. I'm hearing that New York is kind of coming back in the business end. Because people love to consume music and because people love to make it, it stands to reason that someone's going to get in the middle and say, well, I'll take money for this transaction.
Yeah, right, right. That's true. All right. Well, I appreciate your perspective on that. You're giving a talk tomorrow, as you alluded to earlier. I'm wondering if you can take a moment to discuss what that talk's going to be about, and also if there are other aspects of your work that you want to highlight, things you're working on now or that you're planning to start to work on that you are excited about, I suppose.
Well, thanks. Yeah, tomorrow's talk is Psychology for music makers, and it's going to be kind of the highlights of some of the talks that I give at Berkeley, especially to the record production students. We'll talk about how people bond to music. We'll talk about how music can cause us to have an emotional reaction. We'll talk about finding your audience, and we'll talk about recognizing the fact that you're not going to make music that's going to appeal to everyone. If you did, it would be the most bland music imaginable. No more than you'll make a food that appeals to everyone. The only food that appeals to everybody might be water that we can all agree on. Yeah, that's pretty good. But that's, they give you that for free in restaurants. So
for now.
For now, right.
I'm so, such a horrible cynic about everything.
It's a good balance. It's a good balance. I'm such a Pollyanna. But we'll talk about how lessons from brain science can inform record makers, whether you're a musician or producer. And then the thing I'm interested in right now, as I was saying backstage, I will not talk about it tomorrow, but it's a big concern at Berkeley and elsewhere, is hearing health in young musicians and protecting your hearing. Boy, you're going to want to do that. We now know, thanks to the great work that's done at Massachusetts Eye and Ear, we know now the time course of something called audio neuropathy, auditory neuropathy. It refers to the degradation of the auditory path as a function of both noise exposure and just general aging. That noise exposure is going to accelerate the degradation of that path, and it can take years for that to happen. So you want to protect your hearing. When you're at those clubs for megaphono, just wear earplugs. Just do it. You'll be glad you did. If you're a musician playing on stage, put them in. It's not all bad news. We now know that moderate stress, moderate levels of stimulation, actually have a mediating influence on damage. So if you're kind of enjoying yourself while you're pounding your ears, there are some benefits to that. But don't read into that. Moderate stress. I mean, if you're blasting your ears, there's no protection. Right. It's a little bit like the difference between the soreness from having played hockey or the soreness from being pushed down a flight of stairs. Yeah. When you add insult to injury, it's worse than if you had fun when you were getting that injury.
Right. All right. Very well put. Very well put.
Special thanks again to Dr. Susan Rogers for appearing with me at that live event at the Megaphono Festival in Ottawa on this, the 467th episode of Creative Control. I should point out that the machine, we were going to go to a Q&A there. We did go to a Q&A in real life. We had a Q&A with the audience, and it was really fascinating, but unfortunately the machines that were recording our talk started to, I don't know, they lasted most of the thing and then they just stopped working. So I didn't include the Q&A because I didn't have it. So apologies, but still, I hope you enjoyed that great conversation with Dr. Susan Rogers on this, the 467th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available on all iOS and Android platforms and Spotify, YouTube, Audio Boom, these sorts of things as well. If you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at vishkana. And you can also listen to a radio show version of Creative Control on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time around the world at cfru.ca or on an actual radio at 93.3 FM if you're in or near Guelph. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. I'm hoping to keep it going. It's getting a little dicey. Creative Control needs your support. patreon.com/creativecontrol if you'd like to support the show with a financial donation. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts for their in-kind support of the show. Also to my pal Jim Guthrie for letting me use one of his songs to end the show each and every week. And thank you very much for listening to this program and subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends about it as well, and for inviting me to your festival to do a live interview or moderate a panel. That's always fun, and if I can do it, I will definitely try. All right, I have to go, but I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.